I'm Carol Coletta, and this is Smart City. Getting better education results from our public schools, particularly those that serve our poorest young citizens, is a concern for all of us. Both of our guests today have taken up that challenge. Michelle Rhee is CEO and president of the New Teacher Project. Her organization has placed 13,000 new non-traditionally trained teachers in hard-to-staff public schools across the country. Dr. Steven Weber is president of San Diego State University, where his university's influence on the region includes running three public schools with more than 5,000 students in its poorest communities. We'll talk about how to get more out of the $536 billion we spend each year on education, and we'll talk to Rob Lang about megapolitans. But first, the news. I'm Carol Coletta, and you're listening to Smart City. Michelle Rhee is CEO and president of the New Teacher Project. Her commitment to excellence in education began in 1992 when she joined Teach for America. She was an acclaimed teacher in Baltimore's Harlem Park Community School. Intent on having a greater impact on systemic education reform, Michelle began building the New Teacher Project in 1997. The New Teacher Project partners with school systems to increase the number of great people who become teachers. How do you do that, Michelle?
We do that in a few ways. One of the first things that we do is we run alternate route contracts to bring in young and mid-career professionals who are in industry in the corporate world right now to make a career change to come into education. And we also work with school district HR departments to help them figure out how to more effectively and efficiently bring in and hire the most highly qualified certified candidates that are out there.
How do you attract mid-career professionals into teaching?
The first thing that we do when we go into a city is we run an aggressive recruitment campaign that is based on going out there and really sending the message that there are kids who need great teachers tremendously and who really are not being served well by the current public education system. And we are able through those messages to compel a large number of young and mid-career professionals to leave their current jobs and to come into teaching. So we run very aggressive recruitment campaigns. And then we have a selection model through which we ensure that we are only choosing the most highly qualified candidates to come into education. We put them through a rigorous pre-service training over the course of the summer where they are involved in student teaching and they learn the teaching craft from master teachers. And then we place them into classrooms in the fall.
Michelle, what makes a great teacher?
Well, the first thing that we look for is a track record and a history of high achievement, because we believe that one thing that is true of folks who are great at any job is that they have this sort of track record of doing great things and meeting goals. So that's one of the first things that we look for. We also look for really strong content knowledge. A lot of the school districts that we work with really have a dearth of math and science teachers, for example. And the young and mid-career professionals or the mid-career group is a great population to tap into to recruit those high-need subject area teachers. So we look also for subject area knowledge. And then there are a number of other factors that we look for. You know, we look for a level of commitment. We look for people who have extremely high expectations of students. But basically, we want people who understand that kids in inner city urban schools oftentimes don't have the access to the advantages and the resources necessary to have, great life outcomes. And so we're looking for people who are really dedicated and focused on ensuring that as a teacher, they are putting their students in a situation where, there aren't any excuses for why those kids can't achieve. And they work relentlessly to make sure that despite all of the obstacles, they overcome those things and put their kids on a level playing field with kids out in any suburban area.
Well, what stands in the way of outstanding people becoming teachers?
It's interesting. A lot of the candidates that we attract into our program say that they have always thought about teaching. But because they were high achievers, they say that they were never encouraged to become teachers as young folks. But as they have moved into industry and have had high sort of records of achievement or have accomplished a lot, they are beginning to sort of look back and figure out, you know, what can I do to give back to my community? So I think that's one thing. I think the second thing is that it's a real social justice mission to a lot of folks. They feel like it's a real injustice that kids are not given access to an excellent education, knowing that the quality of the teacher is the single most important factor in the achievement of kids, I think really motivates these people because they think, you know what, I as an individual can have a tremendous impact on these kids if I can get into the classroom.
But many people enter teaching and then quit. How do you deal with that problem?
Right. We do a couple of things. First of all, we start screening for this at the front end. When we are recruiting, for example, we send very specific messages about what the realities are in urban school districts. We don't want to paint a rosy picture of a situation that just isn't in existence. We're very realistic with our potential candidates about the challenges that they're going to face. So I think we start with the recruitment in terms of sending the right messages. In terms of selecting these candidates, we really put them through a rigorous selection process to ensure that we believe they have the perseverance and the sort of characteristics necessary to make it through all the challenges and overcome those things. We give them a really clear sense of what it's like to teach in urban public schools. We let them know, you know, what the lack of resources looks like and what challenges they're going to face. And we do that through the selection and pre-service training processes. So before they even enter the classroom, our people have a really, really strong sense of what it means to teach in an inner city school and what they're going to face. And so I think that helps a lot in terms of preparing people and giving them a sense of the challenges they're going to face. Once they enter into the classroom, one of the things that we found to be really effective is that we cluster our teachers together in schools so that they have a built-in support network of other what we call teaching fellows that they can tap into, that they can rely on. And we've found that sort of informal networking goes a long way in terms of making people feel like they're not alone and that they have people who are there with them to help figure things out. And that has positively impacted our retention quite a bit.
Do you get pushback from skeptics who wonder whether the teachers you recruit, the non-traditionally trained teachers, are prepared for the classroom?
You know, when we first start a program in a city, we get some skeptics amongst principals, amongst other teachers. And I think that it's really a skepticism around, are these people prepared to come in and teach? Because the alternate route programs that we run are very different from the traditional preparation programs. You don't learn how to be a teacher over a four-year period like many of the existing teachers have done. So I think that at first sort of they look at our folks and they say, okay, you know, do you really have what it takes to be an effective teacher? What we found, though, is that it doesn't take very long for our folks to win over existing staff. Our folks work extraordinarily hard. Like I said before, they have very strong content knowledge. And we work with them during the selection and pre-service training process to make sure that they have the skills necessary to go into a new environment and with a level of humility, understand sort of what they know and what they don't know, how they can tap into existing teachers who are great and learn from them. So it really doesn't take a long time for our people to win over principals, other teachers through their hard work, the skills and knowledge that they're bringing, and their fresh perspective. Because frankly, a lot of the principals and teachers that are in the existing schools say that one of the best things that our people bring is a freshness to the culture, that they are relentless in getting the resources that their kids need. They bring fresh eyes to different kinds of problems. They have a different skill set in terms of being able to tap into community resources and that sort of thing. So usually that first year is a little rough, but once our fellows establish themselves in schools, then we found that both principals and existing teachers really look forward to hiring many more fellows into their schools.
Your recruits are prepared to work in inner city classrooms?
Yes. And the way that we do this is that our fellows, when they sign up for the program and when they matriculate in, they know full well that we're looking for them to serve in the highest need schools, which are often the lowest performing schools in a particular district. And those schools, unfortunately, are the ones that have the highest numbers of vacancies. They have tremendous turnover at those schools. So typically, there are a large number of vacancies into which we can put a significant portion of our folks. And they are often not the schools that existing teachers are looking to transfer into necessarily.
Tell me, where is the new teacher project operating?
Sure. We operate in most of the large urban school districts across the country. We have a strong presence in New York, in Chicago, in Miami, Philadelphia, and then we work in some of the next range cities like Memphis, D.C., and Baltimore.
And you've been in business how long?
We placed our first teachers in 1998.
So you've been in business long enough to track teacher retention.
Yeah.
Are the teachers you recruit staying on the job?
Definitely. We track the retention of our people quite vigorously, and we compare the retention rates of our folks to the other new teachers in the districts who start at the same time that our folks do. What we've seen on the retention side is that as our programs become more established and institutionalized in a city, that the retention rates go up pretty significantly. And again, I think it goes back to the fact that now in the cities that we have been operating in for a number of years, it's highly unlikely that a new fellow is going to be placed in any school where there isn't an existing cohort of fellows that they can tap into and who support their development as a teacher. And so what we've found in these cities that we've been in a while is that our retention rate is growing pretty steadily, and we attribute that to sort of that clustering effect. We, right now, nationwide, our retention rate for our alternate route folks exceeds the retention rate of new teachers that are placed in urban districts across the country. And in a couple of the districts that we are working in, the retention rates of our alternate route candidates are beginning to exceed the retention rates of traditionally certified teachers.
Is pay an issue?
You know what? It really isn't, especially with these alternate route candidates. What we found over and over again is that people are compelled by the idea, the mission of sort of coming in and helping to provide a great teacher to the kids who need, you know, good teachers the most. We have people who are taking 90% pay cuts sometimes to come from the corporate sector into teaching. And we have on average about 12 applications per vacancy in our program. So we're able to be incredibly selective. And it just goes to show, I think, that when you have aggressive strategic recruitment efforts, that there is really no shortage of people who are interested in answering the call to teach in low-income communities.
Michelle, you are very talented. You're the kind of person that a program like yours would want to attract. Would you work for what a teacher gets paid?
Absolutely. I taught for 3 years. And for someone like me, what was, I think, most compelling was the ability to have so much impact on kids' lives. And I think that's how a lot of our teachers feel. They go into the classroom every day. They see the impact of their work. Our people are very goal-oriented. And to be able to see every year that you are moving a group of kids who, you know, may be performing way below grade level, and if they're effective, they can get those kids to grade level and beyond. I mean, it's very sort of easy to see what the achievement levels look like and what impact that you've had within, you know, any given year. And I think that is very rewarding to our people.
So your teachers are getting results.
Yeah, I think that it's hard, especially at the secondary level, because there aren't as good sort of evaluation tools to be able to look in a value-added manner at what impacts a particular teacher is having. And especially now in the past few years where we have been placing teachers almost solely in the secondary subject areas like math and science, et cetera, where that value-added assessment is not possible, it is, you know, sometimes a little bit frustrating. But we also survey the principals whose schools our fellows are in, and they respond very positively in terms of saying that our fellows are having a significant impact on student achievement levels.
Michelle, I'm familiar with your work in Memphis and your wonderful colleague, Victoria Van Cleef. Part of your work there seems so simple. Get the school system simply to identify open positions much earlier so that they have a better job candidate pool before it's been picked over, you might say. What has been the result of that work?
Well, to give you a little bit of background, when I started this organization 9 years ago, it was during the height of the teacher shortage crisis when the U.S. Department of Education just came out with a statistic that said that we were going to need 2 million teachers over the next 10 years. And at that time, almost every urban school district was opening the school year with tremendous numbers of vacancies across the board, just as often in elementary as they were in math, science, and special education. And back then, people really thought it was a problem of recruitment, that there literally weren't enough people who wanted to teach in these urban environments given the challenges that teachers were facing. And so that's when we started our alternate route programs to try to broaden the pool of people from which school districts were hiring. And as we started doing that work, what we saw was that there were a number of barriers within how school districts were hiring new teachers that were actually stopping the best candidates from matriculating into these districts. And specifically, what we found was that if you ran an aggressive and strategic recruitment campaign, that school districts could actually get a really high quality applicant pool in place. But that the timeline on which teachers were hired, and most urban school districts don't hire a majority of their teachers until a couple weeks before school begins. So that timeline on which teachers were being hired and the sort of bureaucracies that were involved in that were really discouraging the best candidates from ultimately teaching in those districts. So we did a study of four representative urban districts, and what we found was quite astonishing. What we found was that the applicant pools were actually relatively high quality, good people in those, but that between 30 and 60% of the applicant pool were formally withdrawing their applications because they were tired of waiting to see if they were going to get a job, and that people who were withdrawing from the process were much more likely to have, you know, degrees in the hard-to-staff subject areas. They were more likely to be traditionally certified. They were more likely to have high GPAs and graduate from selective colleges. So in essence, these school districts were losing the best candidates and ended up hiring the lowest quality candidates. So given that phenomenon, we have been working with a number of the districts across the country, Memphis included, to work systemically on ensuring that they could move their hiring timelines up and actually capture the highest quality candidates in their applicant pool.
Are teachers' unions your friend or foe?
You know, I think that ultimately teachers' unions are going to be our partner in ensuring that we have the highest quality teaching force possible. And, you know, one of the things that we have identified as a barrier to being able to hire teachers in a timely manner are some of the provisions within teachers' union contracts that govern the movement of incumbent teachers through the voluntary and involuntary transfer processes. What we've found, though, in having discussions with union folks about this is that up until now, there has been no concrete data that shows that those provisions have been a problem. And now that we have been able to show that those provisions are specifically hindering the timeline and therefore districts' ability to capture the best teacher candidates, I think that more and more teachers' unions are going to be very interested in sitting down with us and school districts and school boards and superintendents and figuring out how we all collaborate together to ensure that the best interests of students are met.
Your focus is on teacher quality. Is that the biggest challenge we face in achieving better education results?
I think so. All of the data shows that the single factor that can have the greatest impact on student achievement is the quality of the teacher in the classroom. And I think that if you look at a lot of other things that school districts and schools are looking at, you know, in terms of curriculum and class size and school size and that sort of thing, if you have a great teacher, you can make any of those factors work for you. And it doesn't matter how small your class is or what curriculum you have in place. If you don't have a great teacher in that classroom delivering that curriculum, then you're not going to see the educational outcomes you want for inner city kids.
Thanks very much, Michelle, for talking with us today on Smart City.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Michelle Rhee is CEO and president of the New Teacher Project. I'm Carol Coletta, and you're listening to Smart City. Otis White runs Civic Strategies in Atlanta, and each week he brings us urban insights from around the country. We think of Silicon Valley as one of the most successful regions in the country, and certainly we think of it as a sort of ground zero for innovation. It's interesting to watch Silicon Valley now trying to get out ahead of itself and say, what do we need to do to remain that hotspot of innovation? And they've done that with a new report.
Yeah. Silicon Valley is a place of, virtually everybody knows it. It's the place that's south of San Francisco, sort of centered around the city of San Jose, California. It has given birth to so many companies, from Hewlett-Packard to Google to Apple Computer, Intel. Stanford University is part of the Silicon Valley. It is, it's a very glamorous, economically, it's sort of a glamour region. It has also had its ups and downs. The high-tech world is a boom and bust business, and there have been some times when the folks in Silicon Valley have truly suffered. In the years after 2000, that is the first 5 years or so of this decade, has certainly been one of those. When the great dot-com bubble burst, it probably hurt worse in Silicon Valley than anywhere else. The great thing about Silicon Valley is that every time something goes bust there, they come up with something new. In the 70s and 80s, early 80s, it was a place where they made computer chips, and then it became a place where they made computers, and then it became a place where they made software programs, and then the internet boom came along. Now, so the real question is, so what's next for Silicon Valley? And what seems to be emerging there is they don't really going to make anything in Silicon Valley anymore. They're not even going to make software programs. It's not a great place for programming. What the new slimmed-down Silicon Valley seems to be focused on is some form of creativity, the creation of new products, services, companies, and new business models in the terms of this one regional report. And the best example of that's a very vague description. The best example of it is to look at Apple's iPod, which is not only that device that's in your hands, which, by the way, they don't make in Silicon Valley. It's not only that device in your hands, but it's a whole industry that's grown up around it. It's how you get the music onto it. It's all the fancy covers that you can get for it. It's just a multitude of devices, none of which are made in Silicon Valley, but they are increasingly dreamed up in Silicon Valley. So in the words of this report on the Silicon Valley, it says we're shifting from an economy that's industrially focused to one that relies on creativity for the consumer. Sounds great. Sounds wonderful. Sounds like lots of high-paying jobs, and these certainly are good-paying jobs. Unfortunately, there are going to be fewer of them. And that's also the downside of this reinvention of Silicon Valley. A lot of the computer programmers who used to make a pretty good living in Silicon Valley, the middle-class folks, are moving out because there just won't be as much need for them, and that work can be done cheaper outsourcing it to Bangalore, India, than you can in doing it in San Jose.
It's almost breathtaking how quickly we must adapt our skills to this fast-changing economy.
We'll do it 3 or 4 or 5 or 6 times in our lives.
I just saw a survey that said people actually want to change jobs every 7 years. And I wondered if that's simply an adaptation to reality.
Well, it's just as good, isn't it, that they feel that way.
That's exactly right. Otis, we'll talk to you next week.
Thanks, Carol.
Otis White is a regular columnist for Governing Magazine. After a short break, we'll return to continue our conversation about new strategies for education with San Diego State University President Dr. Stephen Weber. You're listening to Smart City. I'm Carol Coletta, and you're listening to Smart City. Dr. Stephen Weber is president of San Diego State University. He is the past chair of the American Association of State Colleges and Universities and co-chairs Partners for K-12 School Reform. Dr. Weber and the university he leads are deeply involved in the development of San Diego. Steve, how has the job of leading a university changed in the past decade?
Oh, gee, Carol, it's changed so much. Universities are completely different entities because the needs of our society is changing so much. Particularly in urban areas, we are more and more engaged and more involved in helping our communities move into the 21st century.
How are universities different today?
Well, one of the ways I like to think about it is that the old model for universities used to be a kind of ivory tower with a moat around it, and you preserve the purity of the university by keeping the barbarians out. Now it's exactly the opposite. You build bridges. You build bridges with community groups, with schools, with businesses and industries. And of course, as we move into a knowledge society, there are people on the outside of the university that have credentials that are just as good as our own, work in settings that are very, very sophisticated, doing cutting-edge sorts of work. So you want partnerships with those kinds of colleagues.
What is the advantage to universities of those kinds of partnerships?
Well, we get better is the short answer to that. Let me give you a couple examples. San Diego is deeply committed to the biotechnology industry, the major industry. We have more biotech in San Diego than Japan and Germany combined. Now, the biotech industry came to us and they said, we need help getting our products to market and we have a bottleneck through regulatory affairs. Can you help us? We had never thought about regulatory affairs, but in partnership with them, we developed one of the first master's programs in regulatory affairs in the country to respond to a need that we wouldn't have known existed if we hadn't been willing to sit down and listen to people outside the university.
How do you stake out a distinctive role for a state university?
I think it's really going to vary for each institution. Before I came to San Diego State, I was the president of a university in upstate New York. It was a considerably smaller university and a completely different set of issues. Some of the issues were similar. The schools still needed our help, for example. But you didn't have the same industrial base there. The base was more agricultural. So you're going to find the ways in which you can serve your own region. And as you find those things, and this is the important part, you actually become better. You begin to be able to offer new learning experiences both for your faculty and staff, but also for your students. At the same time, you're serving your community.
Admission requirements seem to be rising at many public universities. Is there a danger, Steve, that some students just may not be able to attend college?
Yes, there is. There's probably more of a danger in that regard now than there was even 20 or 30 years ago. Part of the issue is that many of our students in this country are being failed by schools that are not giving them the backgrounds and the skills they need in order to get into this nation's universities, let alone succeed in those universities. So it's a serious problem across the country.
Are community colleges part of the solution?
Oh, absolutely. Everywhere I've been, community colleges are part of the solution. And the key to it, community colleges have some serious challenges. They are typically underfunded. And so what you need to do is you need to put together a close relationship between the community colleges and the four-year institutions to make sure that the students are on track, that they're moving towards a point where they can finish up their community college work and move on into concluding their work at a university.
Are California's universities and community colleges governed by the same body?
No, they're not. Of course, being in California, almost nothing is governed by anything. But in fact, the community colleges are part of a separate organization. And then on the university side, there is the University of California with its group of universities and the California State University with its group. So there are really three major public entities with regard to higher education in California.
Does the fractured system of governance make it difficult to align the interest of community colleges and universities and the matriculation of students from one to another?
It's much more a matter of making it work for your local constituencies. And since those students are students that will often move from the community colleges to our campus, we have a large stake in that. There is in San Diego a wonderful San Diego Community College district led by Constance Carroll, for example. And we work very closely with Constance. She produces great students. We coordinate our curricula. We have clear pathways so that the community college students know going in what courses they need to take and they can move efficiently and effectively forward.
Explain the role, Steve, of research and development at a state university.
Carol, if I could just quibble with your question a little bit. I really think that different universities have different roles and are designed to have different roles. So if I could just speak about what we do and not presume to speak about other universities. For us, we believe in partnering very, very intensively with the local schools. Just last week with the area superintendents meeting with them, we have our own self-interest in doing this because, of course, they're going to produce students that ultimately end up at San Diego State University. But beyond that, it helps make us better. And I'll give you a couple examples. We have a great program in City Heights. And for those of your listeners who don't know San Diego, City Heights is the poorest community in San Diego. And San Diego State University literally runs three schools in City Heights. Rosa Parks is an elementary school, Monroe Clark a middle school, and Hoover High School, all run by San Diego State. And there are over 5,000 students in those three schools. So this is not an educational boutique. This is real time, real effort in real inner city communities, a partnership with Price Charities, with San Diego Unified School District, and with the San Diego Education Association, which is the teachers union. We all came together to make those schools better.
I appreciate what San Diego State is doing with K-12 education, and I want to talk to you about that in some detail, but let's go back for a minute to the question of R&D. So many universities claim that research is their key role in economic development.
That's true. Last year, we did about $130 million in research, grants and contracts.
But does the investment in research necessarily turn into development, something that you can make money with, produce economic return?
Actually, quite a bit of it ends up in products coming to the market. We get a good deal of work. Defense industry is very big here. We do a lot of work with small contractors that are moving towards defense contracts and then with products developed through defense contracts and turning them back into the private market. So we do a lot of work that way. But also so much of the research we do is applied research. San Diego is urban, it's diverse, it's high tech, it's Pacific Rim, and it's Latin America. Those are the R&D questions of the 21st century. So a lot of federal and state money come to San Diego State precisely to have us address real problems and develop real solutions to those problems.
Does it result in local economic development?
Well, we actually have a center for commercialization of these products, and it works with entrepreneurs. We have federal funding to help us with that effort. These are very successful enterprises where you match up ideas and needs, and the role we play is largely the role of a broker facilitating those exchanges.
You began telling us about how San Diego State University is involved in K-12 education. Tell me more about what you're doing there.
We think about these schools as if they were teaching hospitals. They teach us as much as we teach them. We learn from them. We learn from their faculty. It changes the way that we prepare our teachers. San Diego State provides about 2/3 of the local teachers in the San Diego region. So it gives us the real world knowledge and experience we need to make them better teachers, and consequently they're going to send still better students to us. So it's a very nice symbiotic relationship.
How does that real world experience inform the way you prepare teachers?
Well, as I said, City Heights is the poorest community in San Diego. It's also known as San Diego's Ellis Island. We have scores of immigrants coming from all around the world with different cultural and religious traditions. And our schools are very much melting pots of lots of different cultural experiences. And our teachers need to learn how to operate in those kinds of inner city environments.
And what have you learned?
You know, it's hard to summarize it, Carol, because there's so much that we had to learn. First of all, we had to sit down with the teachers and understand their day, and we had to sit down and work with them. And then we came on things that in our curriculum were just out of date. For example, in our curriculum, this is a silly example, but I think it makes the point. In our curriculum, we had wanted our student teachers to have the experience of having a translator come in to work between them and a parent who didn't speak English. And we had assumed that the only languages that would be the case for was Spanish. Well, I mean, we've got over 36 different languages in those schools. So we had to completely rethink how we prepare our students to be teachers in a multilingual environment.
How are your schools different from other local public schools?
These schools are technically called pilots, as distinct from charters. This is an idea that came out of the Boston schools probably now 20 years ago, and it was part of the teacher's contract with San Diego Unified, said that by mutual agreement, they could develop pilot schools and they could have freedom to change the contract as it applied in those schools. So what we did was we sat down, as I said, with Price Charities and the school district and the union, and we all put our heads together saying, okay, now, if we just tried to do this in these schools and make them succeed, how would we do it? And it came up with a whole range of different practices and behaviors that have been very helpful.
What are those different practices and behaviors?
Well, particularly they have to do with how we ourselves as a university then help bring best practices into those schools. We do a lot of work in the schools, developing teachers, doing certification programs and helping them pursue master's degrees programs so that now schools that used to have the least qualified teachers in the district now actually have the most qualified teachers in the district. And where it used to be that we were having an exodus of teachers from inner city schools out to the suburbs, we now actually have a waiting list of teachers from the suburbs wanting to teach in those schools.
But you're able to keep, even attract teachers to your inner city schools?
Precisely so. We treat them as professionals. We value them and what they do in the schools. And they feel that they're accomplishing something. And that translates, incidentally, into very, very good scores for these students. You know, in California, we measure those scores through what's called an API rating. And of all the elementary schools in San Diego, our school, Rosa Parks, had the largest amount of improvement of any. Our middle school, Monroe Clark, came in third of all the middle schools, and Hoover High School came in first of all the high schools. So it is impressive, and of course, I didn't do any of it. Those teachers are doing it, and when they see what they can accomplish, they feel really good about it and motivated and eager to continue.
Are there things that, Steve, you're able to do with your schools because of the university's faculty and student resources that would simply be impossible for other public schools to duplicate?
Let me give you two examples, if you've got a moment. The first I would mention is called School in the Park. Because these are real schools in a real community, and we couldn't just act as if we were a charter school and say we're full and you got to go someplace else, as soon as we opened, we became overcrowded, and we were faced with that usual choice of do we put temporary classrooms, trailers in effect, on our playgrounds, or do we find another way to deal with this? And Saul Price of Price Charities came up with a solution. It was a solution just to a space problem, and it said, well, now, if we take this classroom over here, and we let these students go to Balboa Park, to the museums, and study in the museums for a week, and then that class over there goes for a week, and then that class over there goes for a week, pretty soon you've freed up a classroom. So now we have students studying approved curricula with our teachers in the museums in Balboa Park. And this is one of the most successful things we have done. And it was one of those cases where necessity, the overcrowding in this case, was the mother of invention. But as we measure the things that have made a difference for our students, being in those museums and seeing a world, these students are as bright as any other students, but they're often experientially starved. They haven't seen these things. So when they read about things that are unreal, the reading doesn't stick in their minds. But once they begin to see and experience the richness that you can find in the museums in Balboa Park, then all of a sudden all these lessons take on meaning. Now, every major city in the country has museums of that sort in which they could do this sort of thing.
You mentioned Saul Price. Who is he?
Oh, Saul Price is the person who founded FedMart, which has morphed now into Costco. And he's the head of Price Charities who have helped us fund this. Let me tell you a story. A little third grade boy was in the Museum of Natural History, and he had very rationally concluded that dinosaurs were cartoons. I think that's just as rational a thing as ever. And it wasn't until he was in that museum and ran his hand along a dinosaur's femur and walked along doing that he finally understood the excitement that these creatures were real. And it changed everything for him.
I love that kind of thinking.
Yes, it was a wonderful out-of-the-box solution, and I must be really clear, it wasn't ours. I don't know if we could have thought of it, but Saul thought of it and thought of it not for educational purposes, but it served wonderful educational purposes.
Steve, it's been my pleasure to have you as our guest on Smart City.
Okay, Carol, thank you.
Dr. Steven Weber is president of San Diego State University. Regional decision-making is viewed by many as the answer to suburban sprawl, urban decline, and the fair payment for resources. But regional has typically meant throughout the MSA until now. Rob Lang, director of the Metropolitan Institute at Virginia Tech, explodes the geography of regionalism with a new concept he calls the megapolitan. He predicts that by 2040, the U.S. will have only 11 megapolitans, and that's where all the growth will occur. This is part one of our conversation with Rob. Rob, regionalism has been the focus of so much of the urban dialogue over the past 5 years. Is regionalism, which generally means cooperation at the MSA level, relevant?
Oh, yes, indeed. In fact, it's directly relevant since the iced tea legislation in the 1990s, which made regionalism necessary in order to get a hold of federal funds for transportation. In other words, unless you provided a regional plan, federal government wasn't going to give you money to fix your transportation systems. So it turned a kind of, you know, chatty regionalism about all getting together and feeling good into a really kind of harder regionalism of, you know, without this agency, you don't get money. Regionalism doesn't have to be a regional government for starts. I mean, there's only one true regional government in the United States, and it's Portland. And there's various sort of subforms of Portland in, say, Minneapolis through revenue sharing. But done right, what it is it addresses the issues that are regional issues. And they tend not to be, by the way, you know, local issues like education, but are things like environmental impact, transportation, and economic development. And in terms of those three sectors, let's say, you can clearly make a case that the region exists as one entity. I mean, it has shared job markets, you know, economic fate. It has transportation systems to connect all the different pieces of it, and the scale of a region is at where you feel the biggest impact to the environment in terms of air quality, you name it. If regions focus on those pieces and target those pieces and work together cooperatively and set up a mechanism through COGS or whatever, that's effective regionalism.
What is the role of central city in regionalism?
It varies around the country. I mean, sometimes the central city is really the first among equals. It is just slightly larger than a cluster of bigger suburban cities. And in other cases, it's you know, the dominant player in the case of, say, Chicago or New York. They are the, you know, not just the biggest city in the region. They are a big share of the region in terms of the numbers of people living in them. And in that case, you know, those cities have a special role, which is to say they are the centers of the region's economy. They are the centers of the region's culture and all the rest of that. In other places where, you know, let's say Phoenix, where the downtown is, you know, not necessarily the most dynamic place in the whole metropolitan area, but the central city itself is large and occupies a lot of the region. It, you know, spills into a lot of the, what would have been suburban areas because of, as Russ calls it, elastic boundaries. You know, it just annexed space. Those are really just sort of big suburban cities. And their cooperation and their direct role with the neighboring cities has a different character. And specifically what it is that, you know, they have a downtown. The other places have downtowns. They need to figure out, you know, what are the centers of the metropolis, where there's no center of the metropolitan area, and how do you nourish the centers? And the downtown is just one of these many centers.
Do you think that in any way diminishes the ability of a region to compete?
Well, you know, the health of the biggest central city is key to the region's overall health. I mean, if everybody's running from the central city, in the case of, let's say, Detroit, I don't think it really lifts the suburbs. I mean, the interest and the stake that the region has is that the central city is serving in its role, is a gathering place of the region, is the place where, you know, if the sports team wins, you have a parade in, because it really is the kind of center and the naming of the whole metropolis. It's a terrible thing. If your center city develops a bad reputation, it's hard in public relations terms to go out and advocate for the suburbs as a separate and distinct entity, because the kind of bad PR from the central city spills into the rest of the metropolis. And so there are places where, you know, there's very vibrant suburbs outside of Detroit, but they would be in better shape still if Detroit weren't in, you know, the condition it was in. By contrast, a place like San Francisco has an extremely vibrant central city. New York and its suburbs are booming.
You have suggested that the geography that urban leaders ought to be considering is much bigger than the MSA. You call it the megapolitan. Explain what you mean.
Well, I'm not the only one advocating this, in the sense that the federal government, in its own statistics, has finally come up with a combined statistical area where they show you that, you know, the basis of regionalism has always been that you had a kind of shared economic fate, which is how the federal government originally labeled metropolitan areas and why it's a statistical area. They can show a relationship in terms of labor markets, housing markets. So the federal government has the kind of data that in the next round of the census in 2010 will combine a lot of areas into much bigger clusters than anyone anticipated, like Baltimore, Washington, Richmond, Seattle, maybe Portland, but certainly Sacramento, San Francisco, Tampa, Orlando. And that when they provide that statistic, what they're saying is, you know, just like in the mid-20th century, this is actually the space that people are using. They may not make this commute every day, and only a smaller share of people may, you know, link those two cities. But enough of them do that our models show that, you know, a recession in one would cause problems in the other, and that economic development and prosperity in one would ripple to the other. So, you know, this is the unit at which people ought to start thinking about planning, and including, you know, in a region that scale, there are hot places and cool places as far as, you know, economic development. If you look at, let's say, Washington effectively built high-speed rail to Baltimore, to Richmond, you could imagine that people would live in those cities and commute to Washington, D.C., especially that people don't have to come into work every day anymore. Lots of people only have to go in 2-3 days a week. Then you have a kind of much larger scale in the metropolis, and one of the problems has been, for the census, is that a big share of people who participate in a region's economy don't live in the region.
Rob Lang is director of the Metropolitan Institute at Virginia Tech in Alexandria, Virginia. You're listening to Smart City. CityView's commentator Walker Smith each week brings us his very personal view of life in cities.
Sometimes I lose my cool. Like the time our cat Fred escaped from my wife Joy. I got home late from work after a long day and found Joy frantically scouring the neighborhood for Fred. We had been in our house less than a year, so Joy was afraid that if Fred ran free, he'd get lost. She was using a leash to take him on short walks, but that night Fred had gotten away. I was mad at Joy for losing her grip on a small cat. I was mad at Fred for being a 3-year-old cat and scampering off with a leash around his neck. I was mad about having to tramp through damp neighborhood yards in my dress shoes looking under bushes and porches. The more we looked, the madder I got. But it was too dark, and Fred was nowhere to be found. No sooner had we gotten to our back door than Fred ran by us and disappeared under the house. I got down on my hands and knees and reached for him. I managed to grab the end of his leash, and I dragged him out. I stomped through the mudroom into the kitchen with Fred in tow behind me. I started complaining to Joy, but stopped when I heard a gagging noise behind me. It was Fred. Dragging him, it tightened the leash into a noose, and he was choking for air. I hollered to Joy for a knife and cut the leash away. Fred heaved a dry cough, caught his breath, then nonchalantly walked to his food bowl and began to eat. I sat there on my heels, shocked by the fact that my selfish ire had nearly killed him. It was the instant at which I realized the need to curb my temper. A study just completed at the University of Missouri has found a link between emergency room admissions and anger. 18% of those studied said they were angry just before they were injured, and 13% said they were hostile. Compared to a control sample who were asked about their daily anger levels but who weren't injured, those who were injured reported higher levels of anger, particularly men and those who were injured by others. In other words, anger is not just stressful, it hurts. I guess Fred could tell you that. Because of my anger, he barely escaped with his life. So nowadays, I deliberately avoid situations likely to make me mad, and when I can't, I try to count to 10, which isn't always easy because when anger rises, good intentions are often forgotten. But I remember Fred and that gagging sound. It's my reminder of the stupid, injurious place to which anger takes you. For City Views, this is Walker Smith.
Walker Smith is president of Yankelovich Partners. He comes to us from Georgia Public Radio in Atlanta. Join us online at smartcityradio.com to listen to archive shows, sign up for podcasts, and register for our weekly newsletter. National distribution of Smart City is made possible by the Hyde Family Foundations, investing in programs that generate lasting change to improve the future of Memphis, Tennessee, and its citizens. For more information, visit hydefoundations.org. Eric Rudd is our co-producer and engineer. I'm Carol Coletta.